What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to the podcast. Today, Bill O'Reilly joins us. He's on with us in hour number two to go through everything that went on this week in the news. He's fired up, and it's a great week with Bill. We also have Jack Carr on. He's the author of the Terminalist series of thrillers, which is becoming a series now with Chris Pratt starring in it. It's a great series of books, and he goes through his latest and how it relates to today. Also, we have Joy Reid, and well, we don't have her on, thankfully, but Joy Reid's show and the craziness on MSNBC. Everything is racist. Every single thing, no matter what the circumstances are, we go through new examples of that as well. Make sure to subscribe to blazetv.com/Glenn. The promo code is Glenn. You'll save $10 off your subscription to Blaze TV. When you do that, you will get a brand new Stu Does America tonight. You will get a brand new Glenn TV tonight. And you don't want to miss it. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you have a second, click subscribe to this podcast and click over to Stu Does America. You get a free podcast there every single day as well. And a reminder, if you missed it, the Stu Does America 250th episode podcast of the Power Hour, a disaster, frankly, where we tried to do one shot of beer per minute for an hour. It was very messy. It was a very messy time in our lives, but it was a lot of fun and a great weekend distraction. It's at youtube.com/Stu Does America. Here's the podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
I don't even know where to begin. Ibram X. Kendi. Let's start there with the audio from this, the guy who, you know, wrote the anti-racist baby books and how to be an anti-racist. He's definitely not racist at all. Ibram X. Kendi. Here he is.
So I when I look at that video, I asked myself if that would have been a 16-year-old white girl in a wealthy suburban neighborhood, would the police officer have sought to disarm this girl? Would the police officer sought to talk her down? Would the police officer would have used lethal force? And it's hard for me to believe that that would have happened. It's hard to me to believe that that officer would not have responded differently for a different girl in a different community.
Right, because you're nuts.
Can I ask you a question? Why are we interviewing this guy? It's difficult for him to believe that a white cop wouldn't shoot a white girl. Well, okay. Well, you find it difficult to, in fact, you find it impossible to believe that white people aren't racist. So why are we going, what's the point? We were going to interview Ibram X. Kendi, but we can just tell you he thinks it was a racist move.
Yeah.
You do that on everything. You know, sugar pops have gone up in price. We were going to have Ibram X. Kendi on, but we just wanted to let you know he probably thought that was because of racism.
Right. If your answer to every single case, no matter how different the circumstances, is exactly the same, your value,
you're not interesting.
The value of your commentary is zero, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, who cares?
Right.
And that's what
right.
he is.
That's
a great point. It's like more white people get shot by police, but he can't imagine a white person being shot by police. Well, what the hell is the point of you?
I know. We got it. Just put a card up.
Mm-hmm.
Ibram X. Kendi thinks it was racist. Okay. Rain today. Ibram X. Kendi believes it's racist. All right. Now, here's MSNBC. Now, a guest for MSNBC's Joy Reid, Brittany Cooper, a Rutgers University professor, said this.
The argument for our movements has never been that black people have to be perfect in order for them to deserve dignity, for us to have good policing, for us to be viewed with humanity, for cops to take a breath before they literally get out of the car, guns blazing. So that's the first, right? That this is never what the argument for the movement for black lives has been, is that you just get to kill black people, particularly when they're not being perfect. I think about how perfect, as Reverend Sharpton just said, the prosecution has to be in order to get the conviction for George Floyd. It had to be impeccable. They had to leave no stone unturned. And if that is the standard, stop.
If you're watching the Blaze, you have Al Sharpton, you have this Rutgers professor, and Joy Reid, and they're all like, yep, yep. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we could just put a card up on MSNBC. It just says, we all think this was racist. Right. Whatever.
And my,
whatever. Or they could have two cards. Trump's fault.
Right, yeah. Those are the only two things they could be. And you could have the double card where it says both of those things. It's Trump's fault because it's racist.
Because Trump is racist.
Right. My favorite part of that has to be, though, when she describes the woman stabbing another woman as black people not being perfect.
Right.
That is a hell of a summary.
So I didn't have
stabbing.
A perfect day. I didn't have a perfect day. I killed somebody. I stabbed them. You haven't had a bad day?
Do we not remember, not more than a couple of weeks ago, where the officer in one of the recent mass shootings came out and said, look, and he was just quoting the guy who did the mass shooting. And he was like, look, you know, he said he had a bad day. And, you know, and everyone blasted the cop for just quoting the person. It could be mainly because a lot of the news networks edited the part where he said he was quoting the person. Now, here they are.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah, this is just their opinion, right? This is just their opinion. We just think, black people aren't just being perfect. And if they're not perfect, they might just stab people. And
you
that's
know,
totally fine.
I'm going to stab the S out of you, B, with a knife above your head, ready to plunge into the chest, is a different definition of a bad day than I've ever heard.
Right.
I mean, you know what? Hitler, he just had a bad year.
No, yeah,
1939, bad year for him.
Yeah, bad year. Not an appropriate way to describe it.
No, I mean, he got up. He was having a bad day. This Jewish deli didn't have the bagel ready for him. He had a bad day. What?
And he's a dictator just not being perfect. That's what we can summarize that as. He's killing people. That's more than a bad day.
No, it's not. And, you know, here they come out of the car, guns a-blazing. Do you think they would have shot a white girl? Yes.
Yes.
They wouldn't have negotiated? No, she has a knife above her head saying, I'm going to stab the S out of you. And she's actively moving towards it. Hang on. Can we talk about that feeling? What's happening in your life? Let's talk you back from the... I mean, what are you going to say? There's no negotiation. And they come out of the car blazing. Yeah, do you know how amazing that is, what that cop did in Columbus? That is an amazing... I couldn't have processed that. I'm riddled with ADD. I couldn't have processed that scene in 15 seconds. Could you?
No, absolutely not. I mean, that was, you know, it was Jack Bauer-esque is what it looked like.
It was.
You know, it's a guy coming in and analyzing 10 different moving parts in 15 seconds and doing the right thing. And with 100% certainty, if he had not shot that person at that moment and the knife did plunge into the other girl, Ibram Kendi and Joy Reid would be on the air saying it was because it was racist. They would have protected a white girl. But they didn't protect her because she was a black girl. That's why they allowed the stabbing to happen. 100% certainty that's what they would be saying on the air.
Of course. Because the police have to be perfect. Perfect. Mm-hmm. And even we have found this week, even when they are perfect, not good enough. Just not good enough. But the good news is that Joy Behar has the solution.
Oh, good.
And here it is.
This is what it looked like to me, and I've looked at the tape, and I still can't figure it out. Shoot the gun in the air as a warning, tase a person, shoot them in the leg, shoot them in the behind, you know, stop them somehow. But if the only solution
stop them somehow.
Is to kill a teenager, there's something wrong with this. There's something very, very wrong.
The stabbing was
the thing. Wrong with
society.
With the
way these things are being conducted, even if the cop had to do it, there's something wrong with it.
Okay, stop. Even if he had to do it, there's something wrong with that. Yeah, it's called society is out of control. Teenagers shouldn't be stabbing each other in the streets. That's my idea. And I don't care whose streets it's on. I got to tell you, if two of my rich neighbors are across the street and they're acting like white trash, and they're throwing each other down in the lawn, dragging each other by hair, and trying to stab one another, I'm going to call the police. And in fact, if they are really, you know, I'm going to stab the out of you, I'm going to actually call over the fence, shoot them, or I will shoot them. I mean, you have absolutely no choice. And I love these people. I love these people who have never touched a gun before in their life. Never touched a gun. For that guy to shoot that girl with somebody behind her. Remember, don't shoot at anything. You've got to know what's behind your target, because sometimes the bullets will go through. So this girl that he was trying to protect was half behind the other girl. He shot her four times without wounding the other girl. You know why they don't shoot your legs? Because it's a small target. You go for the body mass. You never shoot a gun to warn. I'm sorry, Joe Biden. Just take your shotgun out and shoot it up in the air. Joy, when you do that with a pistol, let me put it into an old-timey song, because I know you and your cat walk around in your fuzzy slippers drinking a, you know, cup of gin at 4 o'clock in the morning going, I used to be somebody. And I know you're listening to all those sad songs, so bullets keep falling on my head. When you shoot a gun up into the sky, I'm dead. I mean, Joy, what goes up, it doesn't go into space and float around. It's not one of those pieces of space like, we can't launch any satellites anymore because all of these bullets from all those guys in the Wild West, they're all floating around there in space, circling the Earth. They come back down.
And if it came back down and hit someone, particularly a person of color in that community, Ibram X. Kendi and Joy Reid would be on the air saying, they would have never done that in a white community. They would have never cared. No, they would have called that racist, too. I guess maybe you could shoot at the ground is the idea. Of course, there was two people.
Oh, my
people.
Gosh. Are you putting lead in the earth?
on Earth Day, too. That was just
Holy
yesterday.
Holy cow. They wouldn't do that in a white neighborhood.
But we should point out
poisoning the water in that minority neighborhood. They're poisoning by shooting lead into the ground.
Right at his feet at that time was a teenager being kicked in the head by an adult. So we don't want to shoot there. It's just an amazing, there's just nothing that you can do as an officer, which is why I think as an officer, I would be like, okay, this is a no-win situation. What am I doing with my life? You know, I came out here to help people.
Too.
I came out here to help people's communities and keep people safe. And no matter what happens, I'm always the bad guy.
Yep.
I'm always the racist.
Yep.
I'm always the murderer. I'm always ruining my own family because of something that I can't control. And Joy Reid and Ibram Kendi are going to call me a racist if, God forbid, I save a black girl's life. So why would I show up to work the next day? I don't know how they do it. I would like
to add one thing. And when I left this morning, my wife and family said, Dad, stop it. Why are you going into work today? Find another job. You're going to get killed. You're going to be thrown into jail for doing something right. And I've been saying, no, I believe in the system. I'm going to keep standing. Why would you go to work as a I'm asking police officers, why? Why are you still going to work?
I'm glad they are. Because
I am too.
I'm not man enough to do it. I would be, screw this. I'm too selfish. Let me find a different
job. I would just like to say, look, we should have a box on our taxes that say, I want to pay for the police force and I'll fully fund them. And then our tax dollars go locally to fund the police. Those who say, nope, I don't want to. And if you don't pay taxes, if you just don't pay taxes and you're receiving a large sum of money from the government, we still send you a note. I want police protection in my neighborhood. And if I call, I want somebody to come, and not a social service worker, somebody with a gun. If there's something going on, I call.
That's a great idea.
on me.
You don't even have to tie it to taxes. Just a note. I'd be happy with just a survey. You will send a note to everybody's house, and then they can say whether they want a cop to show up or not when something goes down.
Yeah, they all say they don't want. They all say they. And they. When I say they, I don't mean any large swath of communities. I mean these activists. Yeah. These activists are all saying, I don't want you in my community. Okay. Let's go door to door and ask them, would you like police to leave you alone? Good luck with that.
Now, we may have some problems with, like, criminals saying no, and then cops don't go out to the criminal's house because they're trying to avoid prosecution. There may be some holes in this plan. My point, though, is that it's just really frustrating.
Better than holes in little girls who were just having a bad day.
I think.
See how easy it is to win? See how easy it is to win if you just don't care? People going, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You just like, yes, but it's better than holes in little children, Stu.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Joy.
Yeah.
Joy Reed.
All right. Back in just a second, I was wondering which Joy you were talking about, Joy Reed or Joy Behar, who is quite possibly the most ill-named child of all time. Seriously, I don't even think her parents looked at her and went, oh, Joy, she just brings me joy. Her dad had to go, yeah, you give her a few years, she'll make everybody miserable. So I am trying to eat healthier, and I am. But the thing is, I don't like healthy food. I don't like any of it. You've heard of a fat suit, right? I mean, there's got to be. When are we getting a skinny suit? Something that will make me look skinny, because I just want treats all the time. I grew up in a bakery, for the love of Pete. The bad news is no skinny suit is coming. You actually have to do the work, blah, blah, blah. That's why I am eating Built Bars. It satisfies my sweet tooth, but it's a protein bar, but not like, you know, that's like eating stuff at the bottom of my chalkboard usually. This is 100% real chocolate. It's low carb, low sugar. If I'm eating a protein bar as a treat, come on, you gotta know it's good. And I am. Mint brownie, cookies and cream, the new flavors that are coming out all the time, they're fantastic. Go to BuiltBar.com and use the promo code BECK15 for 15% off your order. Your mouth is going to water just looking at them. Trust me, BuiltBar.com, promo code BECK15.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Mr. Bill O'Reilly, I've got about 20 stories I want to go through today. It's been a very big week in the news, but we've got to spend a few minutes on the Chauvin case. Tell me your thoughts on the case.
That's the introduction, Beck. No best-selling author in the world, a perspicacious commentator on radio and TV, none of that. Just Bill O'Reilly. What you... Is that it?
Yeah, that's pretty much. That's pretty much. That's pretty much it.
All right. You step back when in these things. If you're a fair-minded person seeking the truth, not your truth, the truth. So you step back. You don't get emotionally involved, and that's what most people and all journalists, except me and you, don't understand.
I don't know. I've been pretty passionate about this, but passionate
okay,
about
well,
the
well,
truth.
Maybe you don't understand it either, so this is why you have me on. I'll explain it to you. Right now. Okay?
Yeah. Okay.
So the underlying conviction of the former police officer was based on a concept, a legal concept, called depraved indifference. That's why he was convicted. It really doesn't matter what Minnesota law defined as second-degree murder, third-degree murder, manslaughter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really
right.
matter. What the prosecution was able to do was to convince the jury and me, mm-hmm. that the officer who took George Floyd's life showed a depraved indifference.
And it really was because I agree with you. It was the last 90 seconds that
right
and turn this
there
case.
Was a whole bunch of other things. I mean, his own guys were telling him to
right.
ease up and all of that. So if you're going to make a case that this verdict was based upon fear, the jury was afraid for themselves and all that, that's not true. All right. So if you're going to delude yourself, go ahead. The jury may have had fears. I mean, if you're walking into a courtroom every day and you see the National Guard out there and you remember what happened last summer, that you're going to process that.
I think if I were a juror, because I agree with you, knowing the way Minnesota, the way it writes second degree murder and everything else, it is unintentional. It's manslaughter, depraved indifference, and that fits this. And yes. If I were in the jury room, when I started, I would have been like, oh, crap, man, this is going to be bad for my family. But I think by the time the trial was over and I got to the jury room, I might have looked at everybody and went, right? I mean, we dodged a bullet here. This is pretty easy.
Yeah, and there wasn't any dissent on the jury. But remember, you didn't have to serve on that jury. All right? So you could have said in the jury selection, I'm afraid and I can't make a fair verdict because I'm afraid for my personal safety and my family's. And you would have been dismissed. Discharged. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the overarch I want to make is in life, there are certain situations that are beyond a reasonable doubt. And here is one of them. And so every American should accept that fact. And many don't. So that's number one on Chevin. Now, he'll be sentenced. Why? And here's a question everybody should ask. He knew, and so did his attorneys, that they were going to get convicted. The only chance he had was to take the stand, look the jurors in the eye, and say, this is what I did and why I did it. Not making excuses, but an explanation of what was going through his mind. That was the only chance the man had. But he chose not to do it.
Wait. So though, if you were the attorney for his defense, would you have had him testify?
Absolutely. I would have dragged him up and put him in the box. If I were his attorney and I cared about him, all right, because that's the only chance he had. And that was 100-1.
Yeah, that's a Hail Mary and could have made it. Well, I couldn't have made it worse.
What was the alternative?
Right. You're right.
He's going to sit in the penitentiary for 15 years.
Yeah.
That's the alternative. So take your shot in an explanation. But anyway, that's over. He's going to the penitentiary. George Floyd is dead. That's it. What else?
Other police officers will be going to trial this summer.
They'll plea out. They're not going to go to trial. They'll make a deal with the prosecution, and they'll all serve a little jail time. That's what's going to happen there.
Wow. And do you think that's the right thing to do?
If I got a decent deal. I would, because if you don't plea out, then the judge is going to give you two or three times more jail time for putting the system through it. Go ahead.
So I remember Jeffrey Dahmer went to prison and he was shivved. I can't imagine being Chauvin.
No, I can't either. And I don't know how to protect him. Yeah. How do you protect him? So he's going to have to stay in isolation. He'll get an hour to walk around by himself.
That's not
good. What a terrible life, you know? You know, no one feels sorry for him. And in the traditional sense, I don't feel sorry for him, but I have compassion for him.
I do too.
If I could, and I probably will do this, I'll send him all 10 of my books. I'll probably do that. No, I'm
don't
curious.
Don't do it. That's a Geneva Convention, man.
At least he'll have something to do. I'll send him your books. All right? I'll send him lots of books. But I'm trying to say that compassion is what we as Americans are lacking.
It is.
I mean, now he's isolated. My God,
it's amazing to me. I said on Tucker's show on when did this happen? Tuesday, and I said I came out and said, look, I mean, there's two lives completely destroyed. The life of George Floyd and his family destroyed. The same thing with Chauvin. Chauvin is in jail, but his family is destroyed.
Yep.
And we should have compassion for all of that. This week, I have been seeing story after story. It's almost like it was written by Media Matters, where they don't say anything about me saying about compassion for George Floyd or that I thought the verdict was right. They're just saying Glenn Beck says compassion and trying to make it look like I'm for him.
Yeah, you're sympathetic to Chauvin and what he did. But
But compassion, we should be sympathetic for everyone.
But this is another good lesson for people. So we live in the United States of vengeance.
Yeah,
that's where we're living now. Not the United States of compassion. The United States of vengeance. And because you put forth a point of view, and you and I have lived this together for what, 25 years?
Yeah.
We've lived it together. These people, mostly on the left, but not exclusively, want to hurt us. And I put forth, they'd kill us if they
Yeah, they would.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about Brett Favre, because this is something that I think Americans need to understand. He's getting heat because he said, I'm not defending Chauvin, but I can't imagine that he intentionally murdered George Floyd. And I 100% agree with that. I don't think he got up in the morning and was like, I'm going to kill me a black man.
There's a level of responsibility.
And he's paying it. He's paying it. The second degree murder means unintentional. It's manslaughter.
Beck, listen to me.
Yeah.
I don't want this to ever happen again. And so every law enforcement officer in the United States, all 80,200 of them that are working right now, need to understand that their responsibility is much higher than the ordinary citizen, because they are armed and have the powers of arrest.
But we are living in unreasonable times. What happened in Columbus, Ohio? That police officer did everything right.
But he's not going to be charged with anything, and he's having to go through this because of LeBron James and others, and President Biden, who I hope we'll get to in this segment.
We are going to.
Yeah, because that guy is now, he's jumped the shark, if you remember Happy Days.
But getting back
to Favre and getting back to his statement, it's true that Chauvin didn't wake up in the mornings and say to himself, I'm going to go out and hurt a black person today. That didn't happen. But Chauvin apparently didn't understand his responsibility, that he has to be tough and enforce the law, but he also has to be compassionate.
Yeah,
that
I think there was a
comes along correct. With the job.
And the verdict he was charged with, and they found him guilty, and I think this is exactly right, with reckless endangerment.
Yeah.
I mean, he was reckless at his job. That doesn't mean he was intentionally doing it.
No,
he was reckless.
The people who believe, and there are millions of them, tens of millions, the people who believe that law enforcement in America has an animus toward black people use these situations to reinforce that belief. And you are never going to reason them out of it.
I'm not going to play the game by reinforcing it by saying he did intentionally kill. No, he didn't.
But if I'm Brett Favre's advisor, I say, before you wade into this, you have to acknowledge certain things so you don't leave yourself open for unfair attacks. You know, if you watch the No Spin News this weekend, I'm sure you did, Beck, we again produced the statistics from 2019 and 2020 on unarmed black people being shot by police.
Yep. It's over 1,000 a year. Well over 1,000 a year.
No, it's not. It's 30.
That's what the average person believes.
I know.
1,000 people.
30. And in that 30, for 2 years, many, perhaps most of the unarmed black people who were shot by police had a knife or a baseball bat or a vehicle where they were trying to run over the cops. So this is the fact. And those facts were compiled by the Washington Post. All right, I didn't even use FBI facts because I knew what the counter would be on that. But the Washington Post, you can look it up, as Yogi Berra once said.
All right. Back with Mr. Bill O'Reilly from BillO'Reilly.com. His latest bestseller is Killing Crazy Horse, and he comes out with a new one. Actually, I think this is more of his current bestseller because it's already making the lists, and it's not even out until next month, and that is Killing the Mob, probably his best book yet.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
We welcome, I believe for the first time to the program, author of The Devil's Hand and The Terminal List, which The Terminal List is being adapted into an Amazon Prime series with Chris Pratt, which, I mean, that's kind of a good cast call there. Jack Carr is the author, and welcome to the program, Jack. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. When you were writing Terminal List, did you know that you thought this is going to be a big deal? And when you got Chris Pratt, I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm a child of the 80s, so as I was writing the character, it's hard not to think of someone playing that character in the movie, because as you grow up reading all these novels and expecting to one day write novels like that yourself, you just picture it going to the big screen. Of course, streaming services didn't exist back then, and that's an option now. But as I was writing, I thought of Chris Pratt playing the role. And
did you really?
It's completely surreal that now, as I started writing it in December of 2014, and then he optioned it in January of 2018 before it even hit shelves. So completely surreal to me.
I've seen him do a couple of posts where he's just, you know, in his car and he's like, this is going to be amazing.
it's really cool. It's pretty cool.
I really like him.
Yeah, he's great. He's such a nice person. Antoine Fuqua was directing, who did Training Day, Tears of the Sun, Magnificent Seven, Equalizer. And I was on set last week, and there's 350 people out there working on this thing. And it's like a military operation with Kraft Food Services, you know, logistics, feeding the army. You have Antoine up there as the commanding officer. Chris is like the platoon commander, setting the tone, the weapons guy, the explosives guy, transportation. It's just like a military operation. And I couldn't be more thrilled.
Tell me about The Devil's Hand that's just come out.
Yes, this is the fourth one in the series. And for this one, I really wanted to take a breath and put myself in the enemy's shoes, because I thought about that a lot while I was in the SEAL teams, and I continue to think about it today as an author and a citizen. The enemy has had 20 years almost to look at our cards if we're playing poker, look at how we're playing those cards, and then take those lessons and apply them to a future game. So I asked myself, what if I was Iran, China, North Korea, Russia, a super empowered individual, a terrorist organization? What would I have learned from this last 20 years, and what would I apply going forward? So that formed the basis. But then when I outlined this in August of 2019, the catalyst that moves the plot forward is a bioweapon attack. So when COVID hit, I was deep into the research on infectious diseases, the weaponization of infectious diseases, the history. So I was hypersensitive to that when it hit, and it became a much more timely novel than I initially thought at the outset.
What have they learned? You know, I started reading this last night, so I haven't gotten very far. Apologize for that. But started reading it last night, and I was so intrigued, because I think this is why I love action fiction writers, is you have to take things that are real. And up until recently, you know, fiction has to make sense and has to feel like it actually could happen. But in today's world, absolutely anything could elephants. It could rain elephants today. And I'd go, didn't see that coming. But OK, what did they learn from us and our reaction?
Exactly it right there. Sure. Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a lot harder today because if you were to write some of the things that happened over the last year and a half, 10 years ago, people would think it was science fiction, not just fiction. But so in looking at our response to COVID, with the basis of the novel being what the enemy is learning from us and how they are adapting, when COVID hit, once again, they are learning from our response to COVID, a summer of civil unrest that continues today. They're learning from that. A very contentious political season and election cycle. They are certainly learning from that. But specifically to the bioweapon side of the house, when they look at infection rates and mortality rates as they pertain to COVID and see what we did to ourselves with something that has a 0.003-ish type of mortality rate, well, what if something has, which do exist out there, bioweapons with an 85%, 90% mortality rate? Just imagine what we would do. So that really formed the basis of this novel. And now, of course, people are more in tune with that and can see, oh, we shut down the country for something that's killing X number of people. What will we do if it kills the Y number of people going forward? So the enemy's definitely taking notes here.
When you look at what's going on, I feel like we're living in an action thriller right now with the intrigue that is happening with the deep state and the games that are played in Washington and not really knowing who's in charge, you know, at times, and the radicals that are happening and the protests in the street. And it's not a coincidence. And then, you know, with the Great Reset, these corporations coming out and colluding with one another to, you know, help move things along. It is like we're living in I don't even know, but a combination of one of your books and some, you know, awful dystopian Huxley book.
It really is. And it's they're certainly giving me a lot to work with in the thriller genre, that's for sure. And in the military, we talk about walking into an L ambush, like you walk, online or L. Those are the two types of basic ambushes from the beginning of time. And essentially, we're walking right into an L ambush with big tech on one side, big government on the other side. So an L ambush would be, so instead of like right across the street from each other, shooting at someone in the middle where you can kill each other, an L, so you're not, your fields of fire don't hit the people you don't want to, but put this massive volley of fire down on whoever walks into that L. So that's what we're doing right now. We're walking right into this L, and there's not much that we can do about it because those big government has so much control, and they're right there hand in hand with big tech who controls all that information, and we just continue to walk right into it. So the problem I ran into when I got to about October, November last year, being in the enemy's shoes for over a year, I thought, oh my goodness, I have a problem here. If I was the enemy, I might just watch from the outside. I don't need to do anything because we're doing a pretty good job of tearing ourselves apart from the inside out here. So I had to figure that out, which I did. But in reality, we are doing a really good job of doing the enemy's job for them right now.
I will tell you that I've said for a long time, there's going to come a time when all of our enemies will see the same moment and they'll all say, now, go, 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 go. Because we're doing all of the work and they're just waiting for that moment. Do you think we're close to that moment, Jack?
That's exactly right. And the real question is when that moment, and that's what they're asking themselves too, because this is new territory, but they tend to think obviously in terms of eons almost, at least let's say centuries.
Yeah.
What we think in terms of these 4-year election cycles, maybe 8 for the real deep thinkers among us. But they can bide their time. They can be patient. They study their history, which is something we do not do and something our elected officials and our senior military leaders do not do for some reason. They don't put the time, energy, and effort into studying the past to make good decisions going forward based on wisdom. So the enemy has the advantage in that respect, no doubt about it.
When you look at China, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said, stop calling China a rising power. It's a risen power. And until you understand the power that they currently hold, you won't be able to see what's right around the corner. And we were talking about Taiwan, and they asked me if I thought, you know, the American government and the American people would support protecting Taiwan. And I'm like, no, I don't think so at all. I don't think the government will. I don't think this administration. I think just Taiwan, just see ya. Do you think I'm right or wrong on that?
I think you're right, because most people, much like back in the days when we started going to Vietnam, people said, where is that? Even today, Taiwan, right, where is that? For most people, I've been to Taiwan. I've been to mainland China. I've studied a bit of that history, probably just enough to be dangerous. But that's why travel is so important and studying history is so important. And today, there's so many distractions out there for these kids coming up today. Back, let's say, in the 80s, 90s, you could read a book, You could watch a movie. You could wait for your show to come on TV. You could go outside, maybe play Atari 2600. Today, there are so many distractions, and most of those distractions are divisive in nature. And I think that is by design. So we're definitely not getting any brighter and any more wise as a public and as a population. So I hate being a pessimist here, but it's hard to find that hope when you're looking, right, when you're looking forward, especially when you're basing your analysis on what's going on right now.
When you look, because you have so much military experience being in SEALs and everything else, when you look at China and then you look at the United States military, and especially with the leadership we have now and, you know, all the things that are going on in our military, how long before we are in a situation to where we're an even match? Is that still a long way away, or...
Oh, I think it's pretty close, especially when our focus has been elsewhere. And usually, depending on who's in charge, whatever they're studying, whatever they've their experience has been in the past, that's kind of the boogeyman in the closet. So if they're focused on Iran for most of their time in the military, that's the big threat. If they're focused on Russia for most of their time in the military, then that's the main threat. It's because they have this personal connection to it, and they can speak on them. On those. So China can look at our experience in Iraq. They can look at our experience in Afghanistan. They can see the distraction. They can see how we were bogged down because of changing goals, changing goalposts, goal lines, and how we just stayed mirrored down in these areas. And they're taking notes. They can see, they know exactly if that day of confrontation comes, they know exactly what they need to do to bog us down and to win.
One last question. I think that I read this morning that Russia is backing away from the Ukrainian border, which surprised me. What are you seeing on the NATO front in Ukraine and Russia?
Well, NATO has been essentially a non-entity for quite some time now, right, especially with new members, which just confuses the entire the entire entity.
Why? I mean,
in and of itself.
Why would you say that?
I mean, how you have Axis and allies mixed together, trying to figure out a solution when not everybody's on the same page, not everybody believes in the same foundational liberty. So it is a tough one, that is for sure. But I would guess that anything that Russia does, we have to look at them as, essentially they're magicians, and they're distracting you with one hand while they're doing something else with the other. Yeah. That is the best way to look what Russia is doing, particularly in regards to the Ukraine.
Well, best of luck on Terminal List. I can't wait to see it. I mean, I love Chris Pratt, and I think this audience loves Chris Pratt. He's one of the good guys, and he's a great, funny actor and just a great hero on screen. Terminal List will be on Amazon. The Devil's Hand just came out April 13th. Jack Carr, thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.